Physics World.
Hello, I'm Mateen Durrani, and welcome to the Physics World weekly podcast. This podcast is supported by Teledyne Princeton Instruments, which also brings you the Science Off-Camera podcast. Here is host Sebastian Remy with more about that program.
Hi, I am Sebastian Remy and I host the podcast Science Off Camera, where I talk with scientists from around the world about their research, their interests and what drives them.
These 2D materials, I would say they have democratized the materials aspect of doing research.
I did really find, I think, what I love in science, which is hands-on experimental physics.
I'm like a kid in a candy store. You can't explain how interesting this is to me.
Join me and subscribe to Science Off Camera on your favorite podcast platform.
Now, here's an announcement that many physicists around the world will have listened to yesterday.
Med ena hälften till Roger Penrose för upptäckten att bildandet av svarta hål är en robust förutsägelse av den allmänna relativitetsteorin. Och med andra hälften gemensamt till Reinhard Genzel och Andrea Ghez för upptäckten av ett supermassivt kompakt objekt i Vintergatans centrum.
The person you just heard was Göran Hansson, Secretary General of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, announcing the winners of the 2020 Nobel Prize for Physics. And if you don't speak Swedish, he was saying that the winners are Roger Penrose, Reinhard Genzel, and Andrea Ghez, who won for their work on black holes. To explain more about what they did, I'm joined by my colleague Hamish Johnson to talk about the winners. Hi, Hamish.
Hi, Mateen.
Right, so you've written a long news story, Hamish, all about their work. So who are the winners and what did they do to deserve their prizes?
Well, half of the prize went to Roger Penrose of the UK's University of Oxford for providing a mathematical proof that black holes exist.
So he did his work back in the 60s. I mean, back then, did people doubt that black holes existed?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to believe today when, you know, observatories like LIGO and the Event Horizon Telescope are, you know, studying black holes. But there were real doubts in the mid-60s when Penrose did this work. One concern was that people felt that a black hole could not form unless its precursor, let's say a giant star, had perfect spherical symmetry. And the problem there is that stars tend to rotate, and that breaks spherical symmetry. And so it was thought that this would be a barrier to the star collapsing to a single point in space-time. And actually, Roger Penrose was on the radio this morning, on Radio 4 this morning, talking about winning the prize. And he described it, this concern, as a concern that swirling matter could somehow slosh out of a singularity and prevent the black hole from forming. And to address this problem, Penrose invented a new way of using Einstein's general theory of relativity to describe the gravitational collapse to a black hole. And what he showed is that once the collapse started, it must proceed to a singularity, i.e. form a black hole, regardless of the symmetry. So he essentially proved that there was none of this sloshing about, that once a star started to collapse towards becoming a black hole, it definitely became a black hole.
So with the award of the Nobel Prize, we're essentially saying it was Roger Penrose who proved the existence of black holes. Is that it, basically?
Yeah, that's right. That's it. Yeah, he essentially provided a mathematical proof for the existence of black holes. And that was really spurred on generations of astrophysicists and astronomers to, you know, sort of go out there and search for black holes to see if they could actually find them.
So where do Ghez and Genzel fit into the story of black holes? They were the other two people who shared the prize this year.
Well, I suppose they were both astronomers who are searching for black holes. You know, Penrose made a convincing argument that they should exist. But, you know, even today, it's extremely difficult to actually see a black hole. Well, I mean, you can't actually see a black hole because by definition, they don't emit any light and they're extremely small. In fact, there is, you know, a singularity. So even, you know, taking a close look at the region around a black hole is very difficult.
But people have detected them. So how did those two and others working in their teams manage to do that?
Well, it's an interesting story. And actually, it takes place over a relatively long period of time. In the 60s, when Penrose was developing his proof, astronomers were beginning to suspect that supermassive black holes, and so these are black holes millions or billions of times more massive than the sun, were lurking at the centers of galaxies, including the Milky Way. And the reason they thought this is because the centers of galaxies tend to have a very bright nucleus at their center. And astronomers and astrophysicists thought that that this huge amount of light coming out of the centers of galaxies was sort of generated by large amounts of matter falling into a supermassive black hole. But the problem is that you couldn't really get a good look at the center of most galaxies because these regions are shrouded in dust. So while astronomers and astrophysicists knew that there were supermassive objects at the centers of galaxies, they didn't really know whether these were black holes or perhaps very tightly packed clusters of stars.
But presumably, Hamish, they managed to see beyond the dust. So how did they do that?
Well, what astronomers started to do is they started to look at near-infrared light. And in the case of the Milky Way, where Genzel and Ghez made their observations, looking at this near-infrared light allowed them to see through the dust. What they did is they observed several stars that orbited relatively close to the galactic nucleus of the Milky Way. And they made very careful measurements of the relationships between the speeds of the stars and their distances to the nucleus. And the thing is, if the nucleus is indeed a black hole singularity, then the relationship between the speed and distance of the stars should be very distinct. And it would be very different than if the nucleus was a dense region of stars. And you know, the difference is, you know, do you have a real singularity or do you have a relatively large region that's packed in with matter? Those two situations cause the motions of the stars to be very different. And so when they took a close look at this data, they realized that the only way that they could explain the motions of these stars is if they were orbiting a supermassive black hole that weighs about the same as 4 million suns. So now we know that that supermassive black hole is at the center of the Milky Way.
I mean, that sounds like a lot of hard work. It almost as if Roger Penrose had the easy start part of the work. So how did they do all that work? It must have been incredibly difficult and complicated.
Definitely. And earlier today, I spoke to Shep Dolman of Harvard University. He's an expert on supermassive black holes. And he told me how it was done. So here's Shep to explain. So I'm joined down the line from Harvard University by Shep Dolman, who is founding director of the Event Horizon Telescope. And if you recall, that's the telescope that took the fantastic picture recently of the region around a black hole. Now, Shep was also involved in earlier work on supermassive black holes. Hi, Shep. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, good to be here.
So, Shep, could you give us an idea of what it took to really nail down the idea that there is a black hole at the center of the Milky Way?
Sure. It really all got started back in the mid-70s when people turned their attention to the center of our galaxy in the hopes that they would find a supermassive black hole there. And the backstory here is that For a number of years, we had seen in the larger galaxies more distant in the night sky, their cousins or aunts or uncles of the Milky Way, that there were supermassive black holes powering the centers of these galaxies that shine extremely brightly. And the only explanation really was that there was accretion and liberation of gravitational potential energy near these supermassive black holes that caused them to shine so brightly. And so we naturally assume there must be a smaller version of that in our own Milky Way galaxy. And in 1974, two radio astronomers found there was a very compact radio source at the heart of our galaxy. And it looked in many ways like the central compact regions of other galaxies. So that started this idea that there was this black hole there. And radio astronomy then took successively higher angular resolution images of that region. And it always seemed like there was a point source there. So very strong evidence there. And then the optical infrared people started this wonderful campaign that was honored by the Nobel Prizes yesterday to measure the motion of stars around this central object. And they noticed that the velocities of these stars, you know, just kept increasing the closer you got to this central mass. And that indicated there was something very compact at the center that was tossing stars around like planets. You know, it's hard for us to think about because our everyday experience is here in the solar system where a star just moves planets around. But imagine something so massive that that stars are orbiting it. And these two groups, you know, led by Andrea Ghez and Reinhard Genzel, took successively sharper images of these stars. And they used adaptive optics finally to determine that there were a few stars that were orbiting this black hole. And it was the precision measurement of these orbits that told us that within about 1,000 Schwarzschild radii of this central object, so still 1,000 times larger than the black hole itself, that stars were being drawn and orbiting around this object in exactly the way you might expect if there was a black hole there. So that's a huge part of the story, a dominant part of the story. But equally important were two other factors. It's not enough just to know that there's a big mass within a relatively large region. You also have to know that that mass isn't moving. So again, radio astronomers came in and they used interferometric techniques to carefully measure the motion of this radio source at the heart of our galaxy against background extragalactic sources. And they saw that in addition to it being massive, it also wasn't moving. Okay, so now you had this object that was massive and it wasn't moving, which is exactly what you need to nail this case for a black hole. And the third piece of the puzzle was how big was it? And there again, radio interferometry came to make some definitive measurements on how large it was. And it turned out that some measurements made by a number of teams, including my own, found that the size of it was so small that it was exactly the size that Einstein would have predicted for light bending around a supermassive black hole of the mass that the stellar orbit teams had measured. So all three lines of evidence started to weave together to make this story in the 2000s. And the case for the black hole in the center of the Milky Way galaxy has only gotten stronger. So as somebody who was participating in it, as somebody who was marveling at all the technologies that came together, it was just a brilliant story, all with this happy ending of there being a supermassive object in the center of our galaxy.
So that was Shep Dolman at Harvard University telling us that we know for certain that black holes exist. But Hamish, so where's the future of black hole research? Where is it going next?
Well, I mean, I think the future is looking very bright. And indeed, today I also spoke to the astrophysicist Laura Nuttall, who's at the University of Portsmouth, and she works on the LIGO-Virgo gravitational wave detectors, which are actually watching pairs of black holes merge throughout the universe. I spoke to her about the future of black hole research. Here's Laura. I'm joined down the line from the University of Portsmouth by Laura Nuttall, who studies gravitational waves that come from merging black holes. Hi, Laura.
Hi there.
Can you just give us an idea of the sort of research that's going on right now into black holes?
Absolutely. Obviously, I'll be a little bit biased towards my own research and the things that I think I know the most about. So the LIGO and Virgo and Kagra gravitational wave detectors are looking for the collisions of black holes that are about the same size as the sun. This research only really started about 5 years ago. So since then, we have detected on the order of about 14 binary black holes merging. And we have many, many more to detect. So we really just started to get a handle of what the population of black holes are that are about the same size as the sun, up to, say, about 100 times the size of the sun. So that's the gravitational wave research with ground-based detectors. But in the future, we're hoping to put a gravitational wave detector into space called LISA, as well as to build even bigger ground-based detectors. LISA will be looking for much more massive black holes colliding, supermassive black holes, for instance. And the ground-based detectors will actually be looking for what we call seed black holes. So this is potentially the Einstein telescope and the Cosmic Explorer. These will be looking for the first black holes that were created in the universe. So that's extremely exciting. But apart from gravitational wave research, I can easily think of the Event Horizon Telescope, who last year, I think it was, it showed us that marvelous image of the center of a galaxy and a supermassive black hole residing there. I think that captured everybody's imagination, and they will be doing more. In fact, they should be now pointing their array at the black hole at the center of our galaxy, Sagittarius A, which the Nobel laureates studied.
And from your point of view, do you think we're in a golden era of black hole research? I mean, if you were to be advising a young person who's interested in getting into astronomy and astrophysics, would you say black holes, that's the place to be these days?
Again, a little bit biased perhaps from my perspective, but I would certainly say it's on to jump in with both feet. In terms of gravitational wave research, again, the field's only been observing for about 5 years, and our bread and butter is colliding black holes. So there's much, much more that we're going to see from them over the coming decades. And as well, we're going to be trying to open up the gravitational wave sky even further. And that definitely will include way, way more black holes. The Event Horizon, obviously looking at those supermassive black holes. And as well, there's just so many things that black holes kind of form into, play a big part in, such as galaxy formation. So really, it really boils down a lot to black holes of various sizes.
And in terms of your research, what sort of things do you hope to learn, or maybe you're learning already from black holes using data from gravitational wave detectors?
Yeah, so right now with our black holes, I said we've detected about 14 so far. There's going to be way, way more that we're actually going to be, we're currently digging through some of the data that we took last year, so hopefully there's going to be a lot more black holes within it. But really, we're just starting to get a bit of a handle of what the population of black holes look like that are created when a large star dies through a supernova explosion, leaves behind a black hole. So we're really starting to, I think, scratch the surface on, for instance, stellar evolution, understanding the life cycle and mainly the deaths of stars, which is really exciting because that all feeds into understanding about how our universe works. As well with gravitational wave research, particularly looking at black holes, we're studying how much the black holes look like according to Einstein's theory of general relativity. We can't seem to prove him wrong just yet, but we're always looking for deviations away from general relativity, just to give us as many hints as possible to understand the true nature of gravity.
Well, that's great. Thanks. Thanks, Laura. Thanks for being on the Physics World Weekly podcast.
Thank you.
So that was Laura Nuttall from the University of Portsmouth talking about the future of black hole research. But Hamish, another thing that was notable about this year's prize, it's the fourth Nobel Prize, well, only the fourth ever to go to a woman.
Yeah, I mean, that's incredible, really. And, you know, it is a pretty poor record. But I mean, I'm hopeful. I mean, I think that things are looking up. It's great that Andrea Ghez has been honored this year. It was 2018 when Donna Strickland won a Nobel Prize for Physics for her work on lasers. And I think, did that break a, is it a 44-year drought? Mateen?
Yeah, I think it was a long time. Certainly early 1960s was the previous woman before Donna Strickland to win a Nobel Prize. Yeah. And of course, Hamish, both Nobel laureates in chemistry this year are both women. So that was very promising. In fact, I think they were the first women to win a prize jointly without any men being present.
So, yeah, I mean, that's great. And, I think Andrea Ghez winning and also the chemistry prize, you know, to me that, well, hopefully that shows that the Swedish Academy is really serious about, sort of balancing things when it comes to gender for Nobel Prize winners. So, really looking forward to the rest of the prizes and also future prizes and really expecting to see more women mentioned, definitely.
But things haven't always been so good for women, as we mentioned, Hamish. In fact, you and I and some of the others on the Physics World team have been writing a series of blogs this week about people who we think were overlooked for various physics Nobels. And I know you wrote about Chen-Ching Wu in the 1950s. She certainly missed out for her work on parity violation, didn't she?
Yeah, that's a really interesting story. She was a very talented experimentalist at Columbia University, and when she first heard about Li and Yang's prediction of parity violation, she very quickly put together an experiment that was actually done at the National Bureau of Standards, now NIST, in Washington, to measure parity violation in beta decay. And her team, definitely found parity violation and published it in a paper in, I think it was in January 1957. And there were actually two other independent teams that also measured parity violation and published in the same month. But unfortunately, because she published in January 1957, she couldn't share the prize with Li and Yang, who won the 1957 prize for their prediction of parity violation. And that, I believe, is simply a rule of the Nobel Prize, that you cannot win for work published in the year of the prize. So, that is definitely disappointing. But I think what's even more disappointing is that everybody knew how important Wu's contribution was to, our understanding of parity violation. And she was actually nominated several times after for a Nobel Prize for her experimental work. And unfortunately, that never came to pass. And I suppose some people may argue that it was because there were two other groups who pretty well simultaneously made the discovery. And there's this rule that only three people can win. So which three people? I think, there's no doubt that Wu should have been one of those three people. But, that would have been very difficult for the Nobel Committee to decide. And, to me is a very unfortunate situation that's brought up, possibly because Wu was a woman, but also possibly because of the, sometimes archaic rules that govern giving the Nobel Prize.
Yes, yeah, certainly it sounds like Wu could easily have been nominated for a prize or won a prize in a subsequent year. But I also found it very interesting. Our colleague Margaret Harris wrote an article for the Physics World website about Lisa Meitner, who I think, well, I certainly knew that she had never won a Nobel Prize for her work on nuclear fission. What I hadn't realized was that she was nominated 29 times for the Physics Prize and 19 times for the Chemistry Prize. and still never won. I mean, it's astonishing. It's not, I mean, I can't imagine nuclear fission. It's the heart of so many things in physics and society that surely she should have been credited, if not in the year that Otto Hahn won, certainly afterwards.
And the other person that we mentioned in our series overlooked for the Nobel is Jocelyn Bell Burnell, who I think was clearly overlooked for the prize that was given for the discovery of pulsars.
I mean, that's right. She discovered it with Anthony Hewish in 1967 when she built a radio telescope outside Cambridge. And she's always said that her gender had nothing to do with it. It was simply the fact that she was a student at the time. But of course, I know in the 90s, there was another pair of researchers, one student with his supervisor for discovering a different kind of pulsar. So, I don't think ruling students out should be a criterion for winning a Nobel Prize, but certainly she was overlooked, whether it was for her gender or for her being a student, I don't know. And we always laugh, don't we, Hamish, that the Nobel archives remain sealed for 50 years until after a prize has been awarded. So we'll have to wait a few more years to certainly find out why Jocelyn Bell Burnell didn't get a prize that year. But I, for one, am certainly quite interested to find out when those archives open in 2024. And talking about Nobel Prizes, Hamish, we mentioned Roger Penrose today. He's really closely associated with his work on black holes with Stephen Hawking, who, of course, died 2 years ago. Do you think that made it very convenient for the Nobel Committee? Hawking's death meant that the prize could go more easily to Penrose and a set of experimentalists.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's certainly talk about Hawking's work alongside Penrose. And I think Graham Farmello, who I believe is currently working on a biography of Hawking, has tweeted that if Hawking were alive, he definitely would have shared the prize with Penrose, and Martin Rees as well, I think. The astronomer Martin Rees has also said a similar thing. So yes, but again, it's difficult, isn't it? If Hawking were to be alive and to share the prize with Penrose, well, then does that mean that the astronomers are going to be nudged out, because it would be very difficult to pick one astronomer? So you would have a repeat of the Nobel Prize for the discovery of the Higgs boson, where the prize went to theorists very deservedly, but unfortunately the experimentalists at CERN missed out. I don't know. I think it's a very difficult thing. And it all comes down to this rule of three, which it seems very arbitrary. But on the other hand, a few years ago, I talked to Lars Brink, who served on the Nobel Physics Committee, the committee that decides the prize every year. And I asked him about the rule of three, and pointed out that maybe it wasn't particularly relevant anymore because, there are lots of big collaborations. And, his response to me was, well, we don't want 1,000 people calling themselves Nobel laureates. I suppose we still want to keep it special. We want some mystery there, some cachet to it. So I suppose that's fair enough. But, this rule of three really does seem to cause problems, definitely.
Yeah, I suppose it focuses the committee's mind. But on the other hand, I suspect, I hate to say, but I suspect the fact that Hawking died a few years ago made their decision a little bit easier this year to give one half to Penrose and one half to two experimentalists. So I wonder whether in previous years, Hawking and Penrose had been considered, and it was only now following his death that the committee, because of that rule of three, were able to award it conveniently to the right people in their mind. Well, we'll have to wait another 50 years, Hamish. Maybe you and I will still be around to find out what's going on there. But either way, congratulations to the three winners of the 2020 Nobel Prize for Physics. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week's podcast, which is supported by Teledyne, Princeton Instruments. So thanks to Laura Nuttall, Shep Dolman, and Hamish Johnson for joining me today. And a special thanks, as always, to producer Callum Jelf. If you like what you've heard this week, you can subscribe to the Physics World weekly podcast via Apple Podcasts or another app of your choice. Or you can follow us on Spotify. Thanks for listening, and please do join us again next week.
Physics World.